Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Securitized products are bonds that are backed by a pool of loans, including mortgages, auto loans, and credit card receivables, among other assets. Securities that fall within this sector, such as asset-backed securities and collateralized loan obligations, differ from other bonds in that their interest payments are funded by payments made on the underlying loans, and risk is spread across tranches. The yields offered by securitized products tend to be higher than those of other core fixed income sectors, and they give investors exposure to more concentrated parts of the market. For example, investors can make intentional bets on the housing market or the health of the consumer by investing in residential mortgage-backed securities or auto loans. Because of their niche risk exposures, securitized products can help improve a portfolio's risk-adjusted returns and act as a diversifier during periods of uncertainty. On this episode of Insights Now, my co-host Gabriela Santos will be joined by Sameer Riaz, head of securitized research, to explore Sameer's latest views on the sector. If you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning into our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked to the show notes. Now let's get started. Over to you, Gabriela.
Thank you so much, David. Sameer, let's get to it.
Of course.
Securitized debt. What makes that particular part of fixed income special or unique?
Sure. So the securitized market is actually very integral to lending and economic activity in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is we're taking assets that are illiquid. They could be capital or ratings inefficient. We're using the securitized market to transform them into a variety of securities across the risk spectrum. So you can have something that's very risk remote, or you can take more concentrated risk as you go down that risk spectrum. And if you think about the participants and the collateral that we see in the market, it's very diverse. Mm-hmm. You can have commercial and residential real estate. You can have auto manufacturers that are household names that are issuing securities backed by loans to new vehicles, or you can have buy now, pay later loans, which are a newer phenomena in the consumer space. And if you step back and you apply this market to our portfolios and how we think about it, first of all, it's coming at a concession to IG corporates. It's a universe where the vast majority of the securities are not in the benchmark, and it does require a bit more complexity and rigor and analysis. So there is a lot of potential for alpha generation for our actively managed strategies. The other thing I'll add is if you think about a typical multi-sector fixed income portfolio, adding securitized debt, be it consumer, commercial, or residential focused, really adds diversity to the portfolio away from just the interest rate market or the corporate market.
It's amazing how big this market is in the U.S., the securitized market, and what it can offer to portfolios. If we take some of these pieces at a time, the all-important consumer piece, of course. If you look at consumer balance sheets on aggregate in the U.S., they look fine. They even look good.
Yeah.
But what are some of the nuances you see when you're looking, of course, much more beneath the surface in terms of by credit rating or the type of debt?
Sure. So I agree that in aggregate, the consumer is doing very well. You know, household balance sheets are strong. If you think about the consumer's debt obligations, those are actually pretty low as a percentage of their income and their overall net wealth. But if you look under the hood, what we see is a K-shaped recovery. And so on one hand, we have an upper-income consumer that's benefiting from all of those trends that you just mentioned. You know, stocks are up and housing has been extremely strong for the last few years. The household net wealth is really concentrated in that upper income. And in fact, right now what we have is about 10%, the top 10% of earners, are responsible for about half of the spending in this country. And if you think about the tax policy that may be passed, the big beautiful bill, that is only going to help this cohort even more. And then you look at the other cohort, which is the lower income cohort, and I think this is one where we see struggles. You know, inflation has been persistent. I think people are struggling to meet their financial obligations, and it's become more and more difficult for these people to stay current on all of their outstanding debt. When we think about this cohort through the lens of the securitized market, what do we see? We see a trend where the consumer is not necessarily getting better, but credit lenders and underwriters have gotten very strict about who they're lending to. And so even if, you know, we have a weaker consumer, performance in the securitized space has really been quite okay.
So you haven't seen huge spikes in defaults of mortgages or student loans, auto loans?
Nothing beyond what is expected. Obviously, student loans is a whole separate topic. I think one trend we have seen is that you'll have a consumer that is maybe one or two payments behind on an obligation. They're not going to become three or four payments behind. They have the wherewithal to start stay in that delinquency bucket, but not default in terms of securitized speak.
And maybe getting to that student debt portion, which has been so unique, right? Forbearance for years post-pandemic, then the restarting of payments, and now the restarting of actual counting towards credit scores.
Yes.
So what are you seeing there? And is that a problem for the rest of the household obligations?
So to level set, right now we have about 9 million consumers that have student loans that are not making any payments. In addition, there are 10 million borrowers in a program called SAVE, which is a federal program, that are not yet eligible to repay. That's being litigated in the courts. So that 9 million non-payment number could rise if the SAVE program does have to repay. And the median student loan payment in this country is about $400, just to sort of level set the numbers.
Month.
A month, exactly. $400 a month. What are we seeing? So it's been about 3 to 4 months of folks not paying. We're seeing their credit scores move down. That means their access to credit will be curtailed, right? And that will have an impact on a go-forward basis. You also have a younger demographic who may be thinking about starting households. How does that all factor in? So I think there are some medium-term implications to this. In the near term, what we've been focusing on is thinking about the overlap of debt. If you're a younger demographic and you have a student loan, what other types of debt do you have? Is it auto debt? Is it unsecured consumer loan debt? Is it some other type of debt? It may not necessarily be mortgage debt.
Exactly.
Right? And I think unsecured consumer loans is one where we're taking a much closer look and thinking about, you know, the whole financial picture of these consumers, and are they able to make some payments or not? And what does that mean for their creditworthiness and for the securitized debt that we are investing in?
And so interesting, right? For residential, these days, the average age of a buyer of a new home is 39.
Right.
So slightly different cohort than the ones
exactly.
that are just graduating. In terms of the housing market overall, you've mentioned home prices have been on an upward climb, which is great for the wealth effect for those that already own homes.
Yes.
In your space, how do you think about the housing market risks, opportunities?
Sure. So there's a few factors that are happening right now. First of all, just given where rates are, affordability is obviously a very important factor in the market, and it's not very affordable, right? And we've also seen that housing turnover is fairly low because of that, and inventory is also very low. The other thing to remember is that we are in a housing shortage. So over the last 15 years or so, housing starts have not kept up with household formation. And the estimates that we see for a housing shortage in the U.S. is anywhere from 2.5 to about 4 million houses, depending on how you think about all the different factors. So really, there is that secular trend that is going to keep housing prices on an upward trend in the near and medium-term future. If you think just about the myriad of regulations and the different parties involved to restart housing, it's federal policy with the GSEs, it's going to be state and local policies, and you know what happens with NIMBYism and all of these other factors, it's not really something that I think we'll be solving in the very near future. So on a secular level, we like that trend. The other thing I'll add is, you know, the average age of a home buyer is 39 years. The average age of an owner-occupied home in this country is more than 40 years old. So these are very old houses. And even if housing turnover is low and we're not getting as many opportunities in mortgage credit, there are opportunities in assets like residential transition loans where a developer can buy an older house, rehab it, and then sell it for a profit. And, you know, there's a residential transition loan happening in between to sort of facilitate that. We can invest in that in the securitized market.
How interesting. And we all talk about the housing challenges, the lack of supply, but certainly not in our backyard, of course.
Exactly.
So keeps that issue ongoing. What about commercial mortgage loans? And
sure.
Here's where we have had a little bit more concern with rising interest rates, the effect in general of the pandemic on going back to the office. Are we past all of those concerns? Is it actually an opportunity now? How do you think about it?
So we are seeing stability, especially in the office space. And, you know, rightfully so. I think that sector has seen a lot of negative headlines and a lot of negative activity emerging from the pandemic. But if you look at where we are right now, and you think about just the cohort of Fortune 100 companies, their employees on average are in the office about 4 days a week. I think the statistic that was quoted was 3.7 days a week on average. And I've seen just in my own personal life and with people I know, more and more people across industries being asked to go back to the office. So I think the demand side for office is stabilizing. And then you have to think about the supply side. Well, if office has been so negative and financing has been hard to get, really there's been not that much supply of new offices over the last few years. We've seen successful conversions of offices into residential and other properties. So the supply side is also normalizing a little bit. In terms of opportunities, definitely we do see them in what we call trophy assets. And so if you're in New York and you think about Rockefeller Center, the Hudson Yards development, or even the MetLife building, 200 Park Avenue, these were all properties that are either new or they're very centrally located to transit hubs. They've all been in CMBS deals this year, and we've participated in them. The other opportunity we see in commercial real estate, and I'll go back to our discussion on housing and the housing shortage, if people are not buying until they're 39, 40, they need to rent for a much longer time. And there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of secular fundamental backdrop that supports multifamily and single-family rentals. And so just having those portfolios of either apartment buildings or single-family rentals that we see in the CMBS space for us, we do find a lot of opportunity in those.
Mm-hmm. And if you look across your entire space,
mm-hmm.
what's, let's say, top of mind in terms of an opportunity and a risk in
sure.
the space?
So valuations right now are not that attractive, to be honest, right? And what we've been doing is we've been investing in quality issuers across all of the different spaces. So if you think about housing, there's a fundamental backdrop there. If you think about commercial real estate, it's more what is that higher quality property that we can invest in, or is it multifamily, single family rental? We still like the consumer. We're picking our spots. We're focusing on areas like auto loans and home improvement loans, where there could be just a fundamentally strong consumer story. But again, we're thinking about who are the issuers, doing that fundamental research and diligence, and making sure that the underwriting is there. And then I would add in terms of, in terms of risks, what we're seeing is there is a lot of demand for private credit, as well as from insurance companies that have really become much larger buyers of securitized credit due to annuity sales, and that has really taken off. And so if there's that much demand, what does that mean for supply, and what does that mean for credit underwriting, and what are the risks there? And so we're just looking out to see if there's any excess that's going to be built into the system.
And for you, in terms of the yields that are available in your asset class, what are we talking about these days?
Of course.
Be pretty good income.
Yeah. So, you know, if you think about a consumer auto loan rated triple B, that can be 150 above treasuries for something that's about a 3-year average life. If you think about single family rental, the seniors there, that's going to be a 5-year above 100. And, you know, if you're thinking about those yields, that's about 5.5% to 6%. Looks very attractive versus IG corporates.
Very, very attractive. So it sounds like there's so much for you to keep track of. If you think about just how solid the borrower is, if you think about the quality of the underlying asset and what's going on in that particular market, if you think about the issuer and how these loans have been structured, what's a day like for you? How do you do all this?
Yeah, so it's funny because I'd say no day is the same. But, you know, I would bucket my day into really two things. So the first is fundamental investment research. I'm coming in the morning. I'm looking at the news. Is there anything that's relevant to our markets? Is there anything that's relevant to any of the issuers that we're talking to? We also spend a lot of time just doing macro research on housing and commercial real estate and the consumer within our group. And so I think that's a continuous thing where you're thinking about consumer sentiment or what's happening with housing starts. And then there's obviously meeting the issuers and doing that diligence. And I think a lot of people focus on, we're just looking at transactions from one day to another, but we're also meeting with sponsors and issuers because these are living, breathing companies, and we need to think about the quality of the business that we're investing in and what they're doing and how they're underwriting credit. So a lot of our time is focused on that. And then I'd say lastly, you know, there's just the day-to-day new issue transactions that we're looking at and developing our investment research, but all of the work we're doing earlier is really going into building that investment research. And then the second part would be implementation. So my job as a research analyst is not just to generate the ideas, but especially in a sector like securitized debt, which is a bit more complex, a bit more nuanced, we're really working on implementation to make sure that our portfolio management partners, our trading partners are really able to distill our ideas and implement them in a way that is accretive to our performance in our funds.
That's such an important second step, isn't
it? Exactly.
We feel a certain way about the consumer, but then what?
Like exactly.
How specifically is that translated? I'm always curious to hear how people ended up in their seat. So how did you end up focused on securitized debt and as a research analyst in general?
Of course. So I was an econ and math major in college. And when I was looking for full-time placements, securitized credit really stood out to me because of that analytical and quantitative aspect to it. And I think I've been very fortunate. I've worked both on the sell side at JP Morgan and now as an investor here. Just being in research, I get to see so much, right? And it's intellectually challenging. It's very fulfilling because one day I could be thinking about how does a consumer think about a one-year loan, to buy a TV with a firm, and how do they think about commercial real estate and residential real estate? And just that diversity of assets that we're looking at is very, very interesting.
It's never a dull day, for sure.
Exactly.
And now it's time for the bonus round. And if someone did want to get to know your space a little bit better, or just something you like in general, what's a book, a podcast, a movie that you'd recommend? Mm-hmm. And maybe if we could do two, one external, one internal.
Sure. So external, I'd recommend Bloomberg's FIC Focus. So this is a podcast that they have with, you know, a number of different fixed income counterparties. There's always a securitized debt aspect to it. So last month, they were talking about CRE and CMBS. 2 months ago, they were talking about mortgages. So I think it's a very interesting and topical podcast that can happen. And then, you know, internally, I'd say JP Morgan Markets is obviously a great resource to those. But I'd also highlight the fixed income blog that we write. And we've been, pretty active there in writing about different topics that are in our market. So this year we've written about GSE reform, we've written about the consumer, and we've written about how securitized fits into long duration portfolios as well. So I think that's another avenue for folks to look into.
Excellent ideas. If you like to listen, podcast, if you like to read, the blog, the fixed income blog. Thank you so much, Samir, for joining.
Of course.
And thank you so much for listening and watching. Make sure to check out the rest of our Insights Now season, where we've been having other amazing fixed income research analysts for conversations ranging from rates to emerging market debt to municipal bonds and lots more. Thank you, and hopefully we'll see you soon.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Co. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.